The Hand, written by George Simenon, translated by Linda Coverdale, and read by Peter Brook.
Part 1, Chapter 1. I was sitting on the bench in the barn. Not only was I aware of being there, in front of the sagging door that, with each swing, let in a gust of wind and snow, but I saw myself as clearly as in a mirror, noting the incongruity of my situation. The bench was a garden bench, painted red. We had three of them, which we put away for the winter along with the lawnmower, the garden tools, and the window screens. The barn, also of wood painted red, had been a real barn 100 years earlier, but was now nothing more than a vast shed. If I begin with that particular moment, it's because it was a kind of awakening. I had not slept, yet I was emerging, abruptly, into reality. Or was it a new reality that was beginning? But then, what does a man begin to... No, I will not let myself go down that slippery slope. I am a lawyer by profession and have the habit, some even say the mania, of precision. And yet, I don't even know what time it might have been. 2 o'clock? 3 o'clock in the morning? At my feet, on the floor of beaten earth, the pink filament of the small flashlight was still shedding its last gleam without illuminating a thing anymore. With cold, numb fingers, I was trying to strike a match to light my cigarette. I needed to smoke. It was like a sign of recovered reality. The smell of tobacco felt reassuring to me, and I stayed there, leaning forward, elbows on my knees, staring at the huge banging door that might collapse at any moment under the onslaught of the storm. I had been drunk. I probably still was, which has happened to me only twice in my life. I remembered everything, however, the way you remember a dream when laying scraps of it end to end. After a trip to Canada, the Sanders had come to spend the weekend with us. Ray is one of my oldest friends. We studied law together at Yale, and later, after our marriages, we had kept up the connection. So, that evening, Saturday, the 15th of January, when the snow had already begun falling, I'd asked Ray, "How do you feel about coming along with us for drinks at old Ashbridge's place?"
"Harold Ashbridge, from Boston?"
"Yes."
"I thought he spent the winter down at his home in Florida."
10 years ago, he bought some property about 20 miles from here to play the gentleman farmer. He's always there for Christmas and New Year's and only goes off to Florida around mid-January after a big party. Ashbridge is one of the few men who impress me, as is Ray. There are others. Actually, they aren't as rare as all that. Not to mention the women. Mona, for example, Ray's wife, whom I always see as an exotic little animal, although as far as exotic goes, she's barely one quarter Italian by blood.
"He doesn't know me."
"At Ashbridge's, you don't need to know anybody." Isabel was listening without saying a word. Isabel never intervenes in such moments. She is the docile wife par excellence. She does not protest. She simply watches you and passes judgment. At that point, there had been nothing to criticize in my behavior. We went every year to that party at the Ashbridges, which is like a professional obligation. Isabel did not point out that the snow was falling hard and that the drive up to North Hillsdale is a difficult one. In any case, the snowplow had certainly gone by.
"What car are we taking?"
"Mine," I said. And at the back of my mind, it's only now that I discover this, there was a tiny ulterior motive. Ray works on Madison Avenue. He's a partner in one of the biggest ad agencies. I see him almost every time I go to New York and am familiar with his routine. Without being a drinker, he does need 2 or 3 double martinis before each meal, like almost all those in his profession who live on their nerves.